have a very special relationship because both of us are probably the maverick of the systems on both sides. I think President Trump's election was unexpected in your country, and probably my election was unexpected in my country.
Do you ever wonder whether he will serve his full term?
I never wonder that.
French President Emmanuel Macron on Fox News yesterday. He has arrived in Washington for 3 days of meetings with the president. There will be a state dinner tomorrow night, and on Wednesday, he'll speak to a joint session of Congress. The two men seem a lot different politically and personally, but since their first white-knuckle handshake went viral, Macron has worked hard to establish a closer connection with President Trump. So what is Macron standing like at home, and why does he seem so eager to be buddies with Donald Trump? Here to talk about that are Alyssa Rubin, Paris Bureau Chief for The New York Times. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Heather Conley, who directs the Europe Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Welcome to you, Heather.
Thank you so much.
Alyssa, let's begin with you. Tell us a bit about Macron's first year in office. I know he's gotten some pushback for an immigration law that he just signed, more strict immigration law against asylum seekers. How are the French people feeling about him?
Well, I think it's been a bit of an up and down relationship, should we say. I think on the whole, they're still waiting and seeing to kind of gauge whether he's able to really make inroads in the unemployment here, which has been running at about 9 to 10% for a long time, and he's sort of swept into office with promises to sort of renovate the whole work system, but that meant a lot of change, and he's gotten through his proposals and his reforms, which no other president in recent times has been able to, but he's done that because he managed to come in with a very large majority in the parliament. And now there's pushback, there's strikes, there's students who are upset, there are railway workers. And I think how he weathers that in the coming months and whether everything continues to move forward and he actually gets some positive economic results will really count a lot. And we don't really know yet.
And so Heather, obviously the president wants a better economy. The president of France wants a better economy, maybe wants that unemployment rate to dip down some. Is he looking for some economic help from President Trump on this visit?
Well, I think what President Macron wants to do is sort of recreate the greatness of the French state, return it back to a prominent place on the world stage. So in 1 week's time, he can visit with German Chancellor Angela Merkel. He can visit with President Trump this week. And then in a few weeks' time, he's going to have a very significant meetings with President Putin. So he's sort of returning France in a much more proactive way to the world stage. And part of that is, I think, his plan in some ways for domestic reform, because what he wants to show, particularly to Germany and other EU member states, is that he is talking about a very broad European reform agenda. And he's showing that France can take those difficult steps, like keeping its budget within the EU-mandated zone for budget deficits. He is trying to reform the French economy. Exactly as Alicia said, it's a little too early to tell. He's gotten some good wins at his back from just the Eurozone in general economy improving. But we'll have to see. He's not getting traction on EU-wide reforms economically that he had wanted, and we'll see when he meets with President Trump the next 3 days if he gets anything on the Iran nuclear agreement, Syria, or those important tariffs. Mr. Macron is looking for a permanent exemption to the steel and aluminum tariffs. So far, the EU has been exempted, but it's unclear moving forward if it will have those permanent exemptions. So a lot of things are working right now in combination.
And Alyssa, you mentioned that there's been some pushback. All these strikes are happening. Railway workers are striking. University students are unhappy. What exactly are they unhappy about?
Well, I think there are different things going on, but essentially Macron is removing many of the certainties that are built into the French labor system and really making it more like the United States, making it a little bit more competitive, fewer guarantees for workers. The railway system is a particularly, it's not only subsidized, but it's also it's sort of a guaranteed job for life at this point. And he's trying to change, I mean, I think he will change it. And that's something very unsettling. The French have often thought of jobs as being something you get once and then you stay with that company or that part of the government for the rest of your life. And I think that overall, it is one way in which he's a very American-looking, literally looking towards America, sort of president economically. He comes from the private sector himself. He worked for Rothschild, a private bankers. He thinks in a more competitive way.
And what do the French make of him?
They aren't used to that.
Yeah, and what are they then? If he wants to make the French more like the Americans or France more like the United States, what do the French make of him kind of, you know, playing nice with President Trump, whom they do not like?
Right. I think there's a lot of ambivalence. On the one hand, I think they're very proud, as Heather was just saying, to see France back on the world stage in a way that they really weren't under the previous, under President François Hollande. And they want them to be taken very seriously. They, you know, France has a real army. They play on a variety of theaters of war, both in the Middle East and in Africa, and they want to be seen as an important power. At the same time, they don't like Trump, and they're very kind of uncomfortable with if Macron were to get too close to him. But I think so far he's managed to kind of balance his message between being a sort of pro, you know, I'm friends with Trump, I can talk to him, we're two heads of state communicating, and we have some things in common, we have many things that aren't. He's been quite good at straddling that, and at the same time being quite critical, without ever being direct about it with Trump, of the, you know, sort of more authoritarian impulses that we've seen from President Trump, and also speaking up for kind of democracy with a small D. So we'll see if he can maintain it through the week. It's not an easy balance.
Right. And so, Heather, you say that he's looking for some specific guarantees from President Trump. Has he received anything so far from President Trump?
So this is, I think, the challenge for any world leader that visits with the president. We are used to, when we have meetings at the head of state, head of government level, of getting what we call deliverables, pushing an agenda forward. Really, what struck me over the last year, we've had a lot of high-level meetings and visits, but there's nothing afterwards because it's really the President Trump who has to make decisions. And so Prime Minister Abe last week at Mar-a-Lago, you can come with your agenda, but it doesn't seem like you can secure deliverables. And this is where both the Americans and the French, I think, are downplaying the outcomes of this visit. So I think it's a real celebration of the relationship, historic relationship, U.S.-France, and of the two individuals. But I think both sides are saying there's nothing really that's going to come out of it. The president has yet to decide on the Iran nuclear agreement. He has yet to decide on tariffs. Syria, President Macron got a little ahead of the White House, and he was suggesting publicly that he helped move the president in the right direction on Syria to retain military engagement and hopefully a diplomatic process. The White House pulled that back and said, nope, the president is pretty clear we're going to be withdrawing from Syria. So that's what's so difficult about what's going to come out of this. President Macron is going to be speaking to a joint session of Congress. He's doing a student event at George Washington University. He's actually holding a press conference at the very end of this three-day visit. So I think we'll uniquely hear from President Macron the whole time and what the messages he's delivering. But it's very unclear what he will take back to Paris with him to say, I use this great relationship for dot, dot, dot. And we're just not sure what that will be for.
Okay. Hopefully we'll find out more by the end of the week. Heather Conley directs the Europe program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Alyssa Rubin is Paris Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Thank you both. Coming up, the Supreme Court hears two big cases this week, one on President Trump's travel ban, the other on whether Texas illegally drew voting district lines to dilute Black and Latino voting power. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Supreme Court will hear its final cases of the term this week. Two big ones remain. In one, the court takes up another gerrymandering case. It's about district maps in Texas and whether lawmakers drew them to dilute the Black and Hispanic vote. And then the court will consider the most recent iteration of President Trump's travel ban. It is Monday, so that means Jessica Levinson is here to tell us everything we need to know about these cases and more, a lot more. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Legal.
No pressure Monday. Hello.
Exactly. Just tell us about the entire world. All right, let's start with the travel ban case. This will be the final case the justices hear this term. It's a biggie, right? What are the issues here?
Well, and this case has actually spanned not only the entirety of this term, but last term when in June the court said, yes, we will hear your travel ban argument. And then the Trump administration said, oh, wait, we have another third travel ban, which we think you'll like a little better. So in September, the court actually took the oral arguments for an old version of the travel ban off of the docket. And basically what's at issue here is the travel ban constitutional and does it violate federal laws or not? And there's a lot of different arguments at play, but essentially what challengers are saying is, hey, President Trump, we actually listened to you when you were candidate Trump, and we know what you're trying to do here. You're trying to ban Muslims. So even though there have been three different iterations and this particular travel ban looks and sounds a lot more like a legal travel ban, you can't ignore all the history. Mm-hmm. So we have establishment clause problems, which deal with religion and favoring different religions. And then we also have some federal statutory issues.
And then on the other side, on President Trump's side, you have executive authority to set immigration law and to decide who can come into the country and who can't.
Which, by the way, is extremely broad. I mean, no one questions the fact that the president has very broad discretion when it comes to keeping the nation safe, and particularly in the area of immigration law. And he said, we did a worldwide survey, we looked at all of these different countries, and these are the countries where basically I have concerns and people should not be able to just come in. And what the challengers are saying is, yes, President Trump, you have extremely broad authority, but it stops at the point where you cannot be discriminatory. And that's the point that you have hit, President Trump.
And most courts, lower courts, have sided with the petitioners.
For a variety of different reasons, yes. So lower courts have different theories for why the travel ban is problematic. Some courts have said, for instance, the Ninth Circuit, that there's actually a federal immigration law issue. Some courts, like the Fourth Circuit, have said that there's constitutional issues. And I think the real issue to look for the Supreme Court will be for them to desperately try and duck the big issues and for them to find a procedural reason to not rule on that. For instance, they could say maybe that the case wasn't, there's some time issues, that the case isn't timely. Or they could say, you know what, this is just isn't for us to discuss. It's so-called non-justiciable. I'll try not to ever use that word again. I just
don't.
Saw your face.
That's a word ban.
But which is a way of saying we shouldn't be making this decision. It's up to the political branches.
Okay. Let's move on to the gerrymandering case. Speaking of politics, this is in Texas. Lawmakers redrew state house and congressional maps a few years ago. And this case involves allegations of racial discrimination.
There was a very long and winding road, obviously, because it's 7 years later in terms of how this case actually got to the Supreme Court. But at the heart of the case is the issue of whether or not Republican lawmakers use their power to draw both state and federal district lines in a way that violates, meaning dilutes, the voting power of Blacks and Latinos in Texas. And that's going to be the question that the Supreme Court really is struggling with. I'm going to say something really similar to what I just said about the travel ban, which is look for possibly the Supreme Court to make a decision that actually avoids the merits. So there is an issue, for instance, of when this case was appealed, whether or not it was proper to appeal this case at this moment. And if the court wants to try and avoid the big question, it could again go with a procedural decision.
That would be disappointing.
Because you
want them to actually issue their proclamations on the pressing issues of the day.
Or you desperately don't. If you think the Supreme Court is going to rule as I do, if they make a decision on the merits, I think that they will likely rule that Texas actually did draw permissible district lines, in part because the Supreme Court has heard part of this case before and said, hey, Texas lower court, I know that you said that the lawmakers should redraw the district lines because they're not permissible, but we're going to go ahead and push pause on that decision and we'll hear the case. Now, if five members of the Supreme Court were really worried about the district lines, it's hard to see why they would want them to stand. There are some reasons, but if you want to read the tea leaves, it doesn't look great for challengers. So there are some people who would be really happy for the Supreme Court actually to punt on this issue until maybe there's a different makeup of the court.
Okay, let's turn now to another story that's in the news. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein has told the president, apparently, that at the moment he is not a target. A target, that's a key word in the Russia probe. So what does that say to you?
It says potentially a lot or absolutely nothing at all. So there's a couple of different reasons that President Trump could be assured that he is actually not a target. One that I think is maybe the most interesting is that there's a question as to whether a sitting president can be indicted. And part of the reason that somebody becomes a target is that criminal charges are imminent. Now, if you as a sitting president can't be indicted, criminal charges are never imminent. And therefore, that would be one of the reasons that President Trump would be so-called assured that he's not a target. Now, there's another kind of underreported reason, which is part of the Department of Justice manual says, basically, you don't have to tell people they're going to be a target if it's going to impede the investigation. I think we could all understand why telling President Trump, yes, you're a target, could be a problem for the investigation. I mean, other explanations are that Robert Mueller and Rod Rosenstein need some breathing room. And they've said, no, 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 President Trump, you're good, essentially meaning that it's politically expedient to do that at this moment.
I mean, you could be a target later.
Or it could really be that he's merely within the scope of the investigation and he's not a target.
It could be that. Could be Rod Rosenstein saying, I want to keep my job, too. Anything is possible.
Par exemple, right.
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Bernie Sanders brings his liberal ideology to a digital media empire.
What happens when an idea catches fire? When people see the justice of that idea, it moves very, very quickly.
Bernie TV, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Anyone missing this guy?
Today, with your support, we begin a political revolution.
Well, you can get your Bernie fix regularly on Facebook these days. Here he is interviewing Bill Nye, the science guy.
I have colleagues right here in the United States Senate who say, well, you know, yeah, it looks like it is. The earth is getting a little bit warmer. And the science really is not clear. There are always two sides of the story.
Tell me why they are wrong. Well, the science is settled, everybody. Sorry.
Senator Bernie Sanders has been building a media empire, hundreds of video clips and interviews and Facebook Live events just in the last year and with just a few producers. Millions of people tune in to hear Bernie talk about such topics as single-payer health insurance, the depravity of the Trump team, and the corporate media. It's the corporate media he's competing with by going directly to his followers, not unlike a certain White House occupant and his Twitter feed. Gabriel DiBenedetti wrote about what he calls Bernie TV for New York Magazine. Hi.
Hey there.
All right. So tell us about this phenomenon. You're calling it Bernie TV, but there isn't really a title for it. Who's watching this?
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's no title for it, but this is something that Senator Sanders has been building toward for years, and that kind of speaks to who's watching for it. These are the diehards who really started following him during the campaign, but it seems that it's expanded a little bit since then. He's getting millions and millions of people to watch some of these things. You know, he's had a few live-streamed events on Facebook that, during that moment when they're on, are outdrawing CNN. So it's a pretty large audience, you know, millions of people at a time when these videos are doing well. And the idea basically is to get around the mainstream media. And, you know, it's not a message that's particularly new to those of us that have been following us for a while. There were times during the campaign when he would spend just as much time complaining about the corporate media as anything else.
Well, that sounds familiar.
It certainly does. You know, I asked Senator Sanders what he thinks about the obvious comparison to Donald Trump. And in fact, the story starts with a comparison between the two of them, because, of course, during the campaign, a lot of people thought that Donald Trump would start Trump TV after he lost. Of course, he didn't lose, and now we have Bernie TV. Sanders said he understands why people compare them, but obviously they have pretty different complaints about the media. You know, Bernie does not believe that reporters are lying about him. He simply thinks that the corporate media has its incentives wrong. And, for example, it doesn't cover climate change well because of its advertising from fossil fuel companies. You can quibble with that, but it's a different take than Donald Trump has.
Yeah, and so what is he trying to do on Bernie TV, for lack of a better name for it? But like, what are the topics that he wants to address besides climate change?
It's basically all policy. So there's a whole lot about his Medicare for All healthcare proposal. There's a lot about climate change. There's a decent amount about foreign policy. The idea here is to basically talk about issues that he doesn't think are getting covered enough in what he calls the corporate mainstream media. If it's not on CNN, basically he wants to cover it on his Facebook page. So there's a lot of roundtables with college students about how they're struggling to pay for their education. There's one time he went to Canada to talk to folks about their healthcare system. It's a pretty big variety, but the idea here is to talk about policy and never politics.
And how are the production values?
The production value is not bad. It's obviously not an extremely well-produced TV show, but he does have one former producer for Now This News on his staff now, and it's getting more and more professional by the day. It's only produced by three full-time staffers and three interns, but they put out 500 videos in 2017 alone, so they're really cranking them out as quickly as possible. It's not extremely polished, but the idea is to just try and get as much content out there as they can.
And it's not all Bernie Sanders in all of those video clips, right?
That's exactly right. He's in about a quarter of the videos and not anything more than that. Now, his name is certainly on a lot of the videos, if not all of them, somewhere. And it says, you know, Sanders Senate office on the screen. But one of his big criticisms of the corporate media is that it's never really showing regular everyday people talking about what matters to them. So that's something that he's been trying to do a lot, whether it's going out, you know, interviewing people outside of his rallies or simply finding experts in a field that he wants to quote for his, you know, for his policy positions.
But he definitely has a point of view, right? I mean, he's not interviewing people from all over the political spectrum.
This is an important point, absolutely. You know, it is certainly quite left-leaning. It is absolutely in keeping with what he believes in, and it is often focused on the policy positions that he puts out. A lot of it, for example, is on his Medicare for All proposal, and that's actually rubbed a lot of senators the wrong way because, you know, they don't feel that it has a lot of room for debate, and the idea of calling that news, obviously, is a bit controversial, given, of course, the assault that the news media has been under recently. But he says, you know, listen, this is just my point of view and I can do what I want.
Yeah. So why don't other senators do that then?
It's a great question. And that's a question that he has, actually. He says it would seem obvious that other people should be doing this. But other senators, it simply hasn't really occurred to them. I think one thing that I really found with reporting this story out was it's surprising how few people even know that this is happening in Washington. Everyone is so focused on Donald Trump that few people are experimenting with new ways of doing this. But again, Sanders has been trying to get around the mainstream media for four decades now. I found examples of him trying to do versions of this ever since he was mayor of Burlington nearly 30, 40 years ago, when he would try and print his own newspaper to try and get around the local press there, or he had his own radio show, or he had his own cable access television show. So this is something that he's been trying to do for a long time, but the technology has just finally caught up to him.
And I wonder if his colleagues clamor to be on with him, colleagues of his persuasion, that is.
Well, certainly there's a lot of grumbling whenever he does a big event that doesn't include another one of his colleagues who would want to be on with him. They say, listen, man, you could really be helping me with my reelection campaign, or you could really be helping me with my policy rollout, but he's doing his own thing. And that's in keeping with how he's really operated on Capitol Hill for a very long time. He's not necessarily someone who always works hand in hand with other senators, and they certainly don't work hand in hand with him. But there have been a few times when he's collaborated with others. For example, he did a live stream with Elizabeth Warren recently that got a ton of viewers. But there is a decent amount of looking with, you know, sideways at this from other senators saying, well, you know, this is all fine and dandy, but it would be really nice if you got us involved.
Okay, well, I guess this is the obvious question. Is this a setup for a 2020 run?
You know, I asked him that in basically that way, and he said, come on, that's not what this is all about. He genuinely has not made up his mind about whether he's going to run in 2020. But what is clear, both from talking to him and his allies and people that are even quite big detractors of him, is that in 2020, people are going to have to be doing things like this, and he's going to have a huge leg up on people in directly communicating with his base. You know, one of the people that I quote in this story is Hillary Clinton's former press secretary, who obviously had his own good deal of battles with Bernie Sanders. And he said, you know, say what you will about him, but this is the model for how campaigns are going to communicate with people in the future. And Sanders obviously has, you know, a pretty big infrastructure already built.
So he would be in his late 70s, right?
He would. And he admits that if there were any reason for him not to run, his age might be some of it. But he admits, listen, there's nothing he can do about his age. And he genuinely has not made up his mind. But that said, he's been traveling the country, going to rallies with people, even including in states like Iowa and New Hampshire that are very central to the process. He has brought together his advisors, as I've reported, to talk about what 2020 would look like. And he's pretty far ahead in a lot of the early polling. Either him or Joe Biden are really at the front of the field. So it wouldn't be crazy to see him out there again.
All right. Well, until then, you can see him on Facebook, I guess.
That's exactly right.
Gabe DiBenedetti wrote about Bernie TV for New York Magazine. Thanks, Gabe.
Thank you.
Coming up, how a feather fad drove exotic birds to near extinction and made rare feathers a hot commodity for men who tie flies for fly fishing.
If you can tie one with the authentic 19th century Victorian era feathers, then you've got bragging rights in the community and your prestige kind of grows.
The bizarre true crime story of the feather thief, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. After working for a year in Iraq, he oversaw reconstruction efforts in Fallujah, Kirk Wallace Johnson took what was supposed to be a week-long vacation. But on the second night of his Caribbean holiday, he had a PTSD-triggered accident. He sleepwalked out of the second-story window of his hotel room, and he fell to the concrete ground below. And it would take him a year to recover from his injuries. After he did, he threw himself into a new project. He founded the List Project to resettle Iraqi allies. He lobbied in Washington for years to bring more than 2,000 Iraqis who had worked with the United States here to safety. He was really busy and overwhelmed, in need of another distraction. So he took up fly fishing, a hobby that would lead him to a new project to throw himself into. Because while waist high in a river in New Mexico, he learned of a spectacular crime. A feather heist. Yeah, a feather heist. And it would become another years-long obsession for him and the topic of his latest book. It's called The Feather Thief, Beauty, Obsession, and the Natural History Heist of the Century. And Kirk Wallace Johnson joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so you're in the river with your guide, trying to relax. You've unplugged. And he tells you this story about a guy, a young man named Edwin Rist.
Yes.
And Edwin Rist is the protagonist of your story. He's the central character, at least, in this insane heist. What does Edwin Rist have to do with fly fishing?
Well, first off, there were so many parts to the story as he was telling it to me that didn't even sound real or believable to me. Even the name Edwin Rist sounds
made up.
Made up, right? Like some typo on a keyboard or something. Edwin Rist was known as a prodigy and master salmon fly tier. This was a world completely unknown to me up until this moment. But for normal fly fishing, like what I do for trout, you use really ugly kind of small little flies that look like real insects. And that's the whole way it works, is you present a fly that the trout swimming in the river thinks is a real fly and they go for it. Salmon flies are this completely different thing, and they're gorgeous, they're gaudy, they're brightly colored. They'll use feathers from 20 different species of birds. And we're talking about incredibly exotic species of birds from New Guinea, from the cloud forests of Ecuador, from the Amazon, that have iridescent feathers and brightly colored orange and scarlet and canary feathers. And there are these guys in the 19th century, these Victorian aristocrats, that basically developed this art form of developing little unique recipes for each fly that they would name after themselves.
And the recipes are how many feathers for each fly would and go into it and which ones?
Yeah, and exactly, and in which sequence, and how many wraps of the tinsel or gold thread and silkworm gut. And it's this incredibly ornate and esoteric hobby that is still being practiced by a kind of tight-knit community of, it's just, I have to just say, it's like almost exclusively men throughout the world.
And it's only for salmon?
It's only for salmon, but here's the other weird thing. The overwhelming majority of the guys who tie these things do not actually fish. They don't know how to fish. A lot of them don't own any fly rods.
They just like making the little flies?
Yes. They like making these things, and it's a status thing, because if you can tie one with the authentic 19th century Victorian era feathers, then you've got bragging rights in the community and your prestige kind of grows. That's how rare the species are.
And I just imagine the salmon themselves, should they actually hit the water, these flies, don't really know the difference.
Yeah, I mean, there's I'm going to try not to like keep saying how crazy this story is, because there were so many parts that as I was getting pulled deeper and deeper into it, I had a lot of these moments where you can like hear the record scratch. Like, so salmon essentially are colorblind when they're swimming upstream. They're not even feeding anymore. They're going to lay their eggs, and then after they've done that, they're going to protect the eggs in what are called reds underwater. And so salmon are like striking at random things that they think are a threat to their eggs. And so you could catch a salmon with a tuft of dog fur tied to a hook. There's no earthly reason that a salmon in Scotland should have an interest or be evolutionarily drawn towards a greater bird of paradise feather or a, you know, a red ruff fucro feather from Peru or something like that.
It's just tradition. It's just always been this way. And you go back in history in detail how people became obsessed with these exotic feathers, and it has to do with neocolonialism and exploring
And women's fashion.
And women's fashion, right. So started with Marie Antoinette, and she liked a nice feather in her cap, so to speak, or in her huge wig. Mm-hmm. And then it became a madness in the Victorian era. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, there's some debates over, you know, who patient zero was and what ultimately became known as the feather fever. But Marie Antoinette apparently wedged a diamond-encrusted egret feather into her piled hair and set off this craze.
And then 100 years later, it was huge.
Yeah, I mean, like, you could not walk through any major city in the West without seeing women. They had wearing, in some cases, entire stuffed birds on their hats. And beyond just sort of the kind of craziness of the fashion, this has been called by historians the single greatest direct extermination of wildlife in the history of the planet. They became so valuable that in many cases they were hunted to the brink of extinction. And so I get into this a little bit in the book, in that the modern conservation movement really began because of people in the Audubon Society and the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds in the UK that were basically fighting to stop the feather trade for fashion.
And then so the men were also using these feathers for the salmon
fishing? They were basically dipping into a very ready supply that was being harvested from throughout the world. I mean, when the Titanic went down, the most valuable thing in the hold of the ship were crates of feathers.
Wow.
I mean, this was a global madness that really wiped off unimaginable amounts of birds from the face of the planet. But the result of that was the modern conservation movement. And what it did was it placed a lot of the birds that were used in those salmon fly recipes, it put them off limits to fly tiers. And so from that point forward, this community faced a problem. They had a love / passion / obsession for these things, but their supply was now basically limited and dwindling year after year. Mm. And so unless somebody found a new stash. They were the few feathers floating around were becoming more and more expensive with each sale.
So now enter Edwin Rist, because he's now a part of this community. And again, status is measured by your adherence to these old recipes, right? To make these
right
flies. Sorry,
everyone does it. Me too.
To tie the fly. So he hatches a plan. He's living in London because he's a college student. He's studying music.
He's studying the flute, no less.
Yes.
He was such a masterful tire that he was hailed as the future of fly tying by this community in their main publication. He knew everyone in the community. He knew how hard these things were to get. And as he's packing his bags to go to London to study at one of the most prestigious institutes in the world for musical instruction, he gets a message from a friend and mentor of his saying, hey, there's this museum, the British Natural History Museum. You've got to check out their collection. It's like you'll never see birds like this for as long as you live. Like, just pay them a visit. Edwin requested access to the collection from the museum under false pretenses. So he said, hey, I'm a photographer. A friend of mine is doing a dissertation on some birds of paradise. Can you let me into this collection? He shows up and he took the pictures that he said he was going to take of the birds, but he also took pictures of the outside of the museum and kind of made a visual map. And over the course of the subsequent, I think, 7 or 8 months, he obsessively hatched this plan to return in the cover of night and to steal as many of the birds as he could.
So he goes in there. He actually commits the heist. He
takes a train up to this tiny town of Tring. It's like 35 miles north of London. Drags an empty suitcase over 3 miles of a road with no sidewalk. And then slinks up this back alley running behind the museum, crawls on top of a 7-foot-tall brick wall, tries to cut through with his diamond blade, but didn't work, so he bashes it out with a rock, slips through. Spent the next several hours undetected by security, even though an alarm had been set off, and filled his suitcase with 299 bird skins, which by my math they're worth just about $1 million.
So these bird skins are flat. They're flattened animals.
Yes.
Really. And the feathers are all intact. The body's intact.
Exactly.
So he scoops up 299 of these skins and he gets away with it.
Yes.
He gets out. He takes public transportation back.
Yep. He got on a train, disappeared back into the kind of anonymity of the crowd in London. Apparently spread them out on his bed and felt like the richest man in the world.
And was he excited because he was so obsessed with these feathers, or was he excited because he said to himself, this is a big payday for me?
I think it was both. He wanted that prestige of being able to tie whatever he wanted, whenever he wanted, with these rare feathers. But he also wanted to sell these things, in part because he was already getting auditions for, you know, some of the greatest orchestras in the world. I think he had an invitation to audition with the Boston Symphony. And he wanted to buy a new golden flute that I think was $20,000 or $25,000. And so he could make that money by selling a few of these birds.
It is ironic that he's a flute player. I mean, he played the flute before he got into this, I guess.
Oh, but yeah. He started fly tying at 10, and he started the flute a few years earlier. But I mean, he is a virtuoso flautist. This is an immensely talented, gifted individual. He just let this passion take him down a pretty dark path.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Kirk Wallace Johnson. He's the author of The Feather Thief, Beauty, Obsession, and the Natural History Heist of the Century. So he's caught eventually, and he pleaded guilty because he's...
They had him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They raid his apartment, and they are the skins, mm-hmm. or some of them. And he has this really unusual defense, the Asperger's defense.
Yeah.
Which worked.
It worked. And it works. It's not so uncommon in the UK. Now, in the interview that I eventually had with Edwin, And this took me 3.5 years, I think, to finally get him to agree to talk. And it was all on the record. At about the 5 or 6 hour mark, we got to the Asperger's discussion. And I said to him, you know, I'm not a clinician. I fully admit my ignorance on this, but you don't seem like you have Asperger's to me. Like, you're making perfect eye contact. You're reading the subtext of a lot of my questions. I mean, he was a formidable interview subject. And he told me, he goes, yeah, you know, I don't have Asperger's. And he said, I quote this in the book, but so I'll paraphrase it here just so I don't get myself in trouble. But he basically told me that he became what he needed to be. You know, he said on eye contact, for example, you look at eye contact, those are the symptoms of Asperger's. I don't have any problem looking anyone in the eyes. Suddenly now I'm having difficulty looking at someone in the eyes. And then he started rocking backwards and forth in the chair to kind of give me the full effect of like, of what he was aping in the middle of this interview. So he secures the diagnosis, which then the lawyers present to the courtroom. And he was given a suspended sentence, which just means so long as he doesn't break into another museum for a year, he'll be fine. He was told to pay back some small amount of money.
What about returning the skins?
When they arrested him, they found of the 299 birds, about a third of them were intact with the specimen labels tied around their feet. There were like roughly a third that were intact but did not have the labels, which is a big blow to science because once you separate that, you don't really know which bird was gathered at what date. And then there were a third of the birds that were missing. And I think that the museum and the Brits were just so embarrassed by this theft of their heritage and a kind of not falling asleep at the wheel, but this was a pretty easily done job, that when the sentence was handed down, they basically said, well, we're pleased that this matter is now resolved. And the investigation, everything stopped from that point onwards, even though about a third of the birds were still out there in the world. Nobody knew if they were in some long-term storage locker in some random town somewhere or if they were already all plucked and sold into the flytime community. Nobody knew, and nobody was asking anything anymore.
So you decide you need to find those 100 skins. it becomes your obsession.
Yeah, it's hard to think about this without blushing a little bit because at this point in my life, I didn't care about solving unsolved crimes. I didn't know anything about salmon flies. I just thought it was such a bizarre story that it initially just started kind of like a little side hobby. I just wanted to understand, like, did it really happen? Like, is this true? Like, why on earth are they spending so much money for these feathers? Why can't they just use something else or whatever? But as soon as I started poking around, I started getting threats from the fly tires telling me not to mess around with this story. every step I took just pulled me deeper in where I was just like, no one is ever going to believe this. Like,
so you became almost as obsessive as they are about their fly tying.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like I don't tie these things myself, but it turned into like a game. And then once I realized the scientific value and that essentially that this theft had blown open a huge hole in the scientific record, that's when I kind of just appointed myself the rescuer of these birds. And I was like, I'm going to just do what the British police didn't do. And I'm going to go find these things. How hard can it be?
Dot, dot, dot.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I won't give it away what happens. But I do want to know if Edwin, when you spoke with him and you spoke with him for like 8 hours straight, if at the end of that conversation, he expressed any remorse for what he did.
I did not find someone who's really struggling with what they've done. I think he recognizes that for all intents and purposes, he got away with it. And he's, you know, moving on with his life. He's performing with orchestras throughout Germany now under a different name. There are other people that were tangentially involved in all of this who are far more remorseful than he is, I should say. But
and then in terms of this community, are they now thinking that maybe they shouldn't be using these feathers, these black market feathers?
There's two tracks of response at this point in the community. The first one, which I'm excited about, is that there is a growing movement towards what they call sustainable fly tying, which is essentially just using feathers from game birds that are under no threat of extinction and where it's legal to hunt and to possess. And I mean, you could...
Like a rooster.
Yeah, a rooster or a turkey or whatever. But the other half of the community, or maybe it's the, I mean, it feels like the majority, honestly, seems to be deeply concerned and agitated by this book. At a recent fly tying symposium, and yes, these things do exist.
They have their own magazine.
Oh, yeah, for sure. A source of mine told me he kept hearing people say, we better sell off all this stuff before Kirk's book comes out and the feds come down on us. There's a forum post, the administrator of this classic fly tying forum, the most recent post he did the other morning said that something, I think the line was, demons are going to be reborn when this book comes out, that like everybody better watch out, you know. My wife is worried that we're going to have to, you know, go into witness protection or something, but I refuse to believe that after everything I went through in Fallujah that it's going to be a fly tire that brings me down, you know.
Well, let's hope not. Kirk, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
Kirk Wallace Johnson, his new book is called The Feather Thief, Beauty, Obsession, and the Natural History Heist of the Century. He's going to launch the book tomorrow here in LA at a free event at the Natural History Museum. Thanks.
Thank you.
And Christian Bordahl is here now with some listener feedback. Hello.
Yes. Hey there, Madeline. So you talked earlier with our legal eagle, Jessica Levinson, about the last oral arguments going on at the Supreme Court session.
I did.
And one of the big issues before the court, of course, is the third iteration of the president's travel ban. And as I am wont to do, I put up a Twitter poll about this important issue facing the nation. And I asked our listeners the following question. Should the court support the president's right to protect the homeland by banning people from certain countries from entry? Well, some of our listeners took issue with that question itself. Rob said, curious framing of the issue there, pal. Gretchen Robbins said, how about it's not the court's job to support him, it's their job to uphold the law. If it happens to not support him, I'm good with that because it'll bother him. But hashtag rule of law is first. Randy Corthen simply called my question slanted. Well, apparently it wasn't so slanted that it really changed the results of my poll from what one might have expected it to be. The question again, should the court support the president's right to protect the homeland by banning people from certain countries from entry? The results were 11% saying yes, that's his job. 80% said not in this case, and that left 9% who are still undecided about the questions about the president's job when it comes to banning people from certain countries from entry.
Okay. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
For making feedback great again.
Yes,
you
that's my job.
Sure did. Okay, Christian Bordahl, thank you. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.